Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Rundown for July 13, 2026. This week, we indexed 171 new orthopedic studies across 34 journals. The 75 highest impact studies are featured on the site, and we're covering the top 25 studies in this audio digest. As always, studies are ranked by our impact algorithm, which weighs journal tier and level of evidence. Let's start with our first study. Shivakumar and colleagues published in NEJM, titled Rivaroxaban Then Aspirin versus Aspirin Alone After Total Hip or Knee Arthroplasty. EPCAT-3 randomized 5,429 total hip and knee arthroplasty patients to aspirin alone at 81 mg daily versus Rivaroxaban 10 mg for 5 days, followed by aspirin for the remainder of the prophylaxis period. Symptomatic venous thromboembolism, proximal deep vein thrombosis, or pulmonary embolism, occurred in 0.48% of the aspirin alone group versus 0.45% in the rivaroxaban aspirin group, meeting the pre-specified non-inferiority margin of 0.7 percentage points. Major or clinically relevant non-major bleeding was similar between groups at 1.66% versus 2.04%. One limitation to note is that the trial enrolled patients deemed suitable for aspirin prophylaxis by their surgeons, introducing selection bias that excludes higher-risk patients. Overall, aspirin alone at 81 mg daily was non-inferior to rivaroxaban then aspirin for symptomatic venous thromboembolism prevention after total hip and knee arthroplasty, with rates of 0.48% versus 0.45%. Moving on, Grun and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled A Randomized Controlled Trial of Primary Arthrodesis versus Temporary Bridge Plating in Unstable Lisfranc Injuries, a concise follow-up at 10 years. This concise follow-up to a previously published randomized controlled trial compared primary arthrodesis versus temporary bridge plating for unstable Lisfranc injuries at 10-year follow-up. Primary arthrodesis demonstrated superior functional outcomes with AOFAS scores of 88 versus 76 and lower reoperation rates than bridge plating at long-term follow-up. One limitation to note is that loss to follow-up over a 10-year interval is likely substantial and may introduce survivorship bias. Overall, at 10-year follow-up, primary arthrodesis for unstable Lisfranc injuries produced superior AOFAS scores of 88 versus 76. And lower reoperation rates compared to temporary bridge plating. Moving on, Tsuchiya and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Intraoperative Surgical Smoke During Arthroplasty, Early Unhealthy Level Exposure. This single-center prospective study quantified intraoperative PM2.5 surgical smoke exposure across 3 arthroplasty procedures using a portable air quality monitor mapped to AQI categories. BHA and total knee arthroplasty produced median maximum PM2.5 concentrations of 129.50 and 118.80 micrograms per cubic meter, respectively, versus 6.14 micrograms per cubic meter for anterior approach total hip arthroplasty, with adjusted odds ratios of 34.28 and 21.97 for reaching unhealthy AQI compared to total hip arthroplasty. PM2.5 spikes occurred early, by 25% of surgical time, driven by electrocautery during field development in BHA and total knee arthroplasty. One limitation to note is that all total hip arthroplasty cases use the direct anterior approach, making it impossible to determine whether the dramatically lower PM2.5 reflects the approach, the procedure itself, or differences in soft tissue handling. Overall, BHA via direct lateral approach and total knee arthroplasty reached AQI unhealthy thresholds in 80% and 71% of cases, respectively, by 25% of normalized surgical time, with median maximum PM2.5 of 129.50 and 118.80 micrograms per cubic meter versus 6.14 micrograms per cubic meter for anterior approach total hip arthroplasty. Moving on, Ott and colleagues published in JAMA, titled Controversies About Osteoporotic Fracture Prevention Strategies. The abstract for this article was not available in PubMed at the time of processing. Please refer to the original publication in JAMA for full details. One limitation to note is that the abstract was not available for analysis. Overall, abstract not available. See the original article for details. Moving on, Malman and colleagues published in BJSM titled Effects of Different Exercise Training Modalities on 24-Hour Ambulatory Blood Pressure in Adults with Hypertension, a network meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. This network meta-analysis compared exercise training modalities on 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure in hypertensive adults across 31 randomized controlled trials. Combined training reduced 24-hour systolic blood pressure by 6.18 millimeters mercury and diastolic blood pressure by 3.94 millimeters mercury. Aerobic training reduced systolic by 4.73 millimeters mercury and diastolic by 2.76 millimeters mercury. And HIIT reduced systolic by 5.71 millimeters mercury and diastolic by 4.64 millimeters mercury versus control. Direct exercise versus exercise comparisons were inconclusive, and evidence for resistance training and non-conventional modalities remained imprecise. One limitation to note is that exercise versus exercise comparisons were statistically inconclusive due to sparse direct evidence. Overall, combined training produced the largest reduction in 24-hour systolic blood pressure at 6.18 millimeters mercury among hypertensive adults, but no exercise modality demonstrated superiority over another in head-to-head comparisons. Moving on, Klinke and colleagues published in JOA titled Tourniquet Use in Cemented Total Knee Arthroplasty: Small Gains in Fixation, No Clear Benefit in Aseptic Loosening, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This PRISMA 2020 compliant meta-analysis compared cemented primary total knee arthroplasty performed with versus without tourniquet across 26 studies and 54,561 knees. Tourniquet use was associated with greater cumulative tibial base plate cement penetration, 6-zone mean difference of 0.92 millimeters and 10-zone mean difference of 2.59 millimeters, and lower all-cause revision risk with a relative risk of 1.38 without tourniquet. However, no differences were found in radiostereometric analysis or migration at 12 or 24 months, radiolucent lines, or revision specifically for aseptic loosening. One limitation to note is that the all-cause revision outcome pulls heterogeneous failure modes across registry and randomized controlled trial data without stratification. Overall, tourniquet use in cemented primary total knee arthroplasty reduced all-cause revision with a relative risk of 1.38 without tourniquet. 95% confidence interval, 1.18 to 1.61, but did not reduce aseptic loosening rates or improve radiostereometric analysis migration at 12 to 24 months. Moving on, Allison and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Association of Early Knee Extension Range of Motion Deficits with Cartilage T2 Relaxation Following Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction. This study asked whether knee extension range of motion deficit greater than 3 degrees at 2 months post-ACL reconstruction predicts early cartilage compositional changes measured by T2 relaxometry at 6 months. 30 patients aged 15 to 35 underwent quantitative MRI preoperatively and at 6 months. 50% had an extension deficit at 2 months. Those with deficits showed significantly greater T2 increases in the anterior medial femoral condyle at 10.21% and in the weight-bearing zone at 6.14%, with no significant differences in other cartilage regions. One limitation to note is that T2 relaxation time elevation reflects cartilage water content and collagen disorganization, but does not establish causality or predict progression to clinically significant osteoarthritis. Overall, extension deficit greater than 3 degrees at 2 months post-ACL reconstruction is associated with 10.21% greater T2 increase in anterior medial femoral condyle cartilage and 6.14% greater increase in the weight-bearing zone at 6 months. Landers and colleagues published in KSSTA titled No Clear Benefit of Patient-Specific Instruments Over Conventional Instrumentation in Unicompartmental Knee Arthroplasty, a secondary analysis of a multi-center randomized trial with 5-year follow-up. This secondary analysis of a two-center randomized controlled trial compared patient-specific instruments versus conventional instrumentation for unicompartmental knee arthroplasty across revision rate and 6 patient-reported outcome measures at minimum 5-year follow-up. Revision rates were 14.3% with patient-specific instruments versus 5.1% with conventional instrumentation, a clinically meaningful difference that did not reach statistical significance. All patient-reported outcome measures, Oxford Knee Score, Western Ontario and McMaster University's Arthritis Index, EQ5D Quality of Life Score, 3L, EQ5D Visual Analog Score, Numeric Rating Scale for Pain, and FJS-12, improved significantly from baseline in both groups with no between-group difference. One limitation to note is that the study is underpowered for its primary survivorship endpoint. Overall, at 5-year follow-up, patient-specific instruments showed a numerically higher but non-significant revision rate versus conventional instrumentation in unicompartmental knee arthroplasty at 14.3% versus 5.1% with no difference in any patient-reported outcome measure. Moving on, Lin and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine titled Quantitative Investigation of Tibiofemoral Cartilage Early Degeneration After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, an integrated biomechanical and longitudinal MRO analysis. This study investigated whether altered dynamic contact pressure after ACL reconstruction mechanistically drives early cartilage degeneration by combining 3-year longitudinal quantitative MRI in 30 ACL reconstruction patients with 6 degree of freedom robotic gait simulation in 8 cadaveric knees. MRI demonstrated significant cartilage thinning across posterior and central tibial subregions bilaterally, with the greatest loss in the internal medial tibia at 21%. Robotic simulation showed reconstructed knees maintained a posteriorly displaced pressure center throughout the gait cycle and exhibited enlarged contact area in early stance and terminal swing, particularly medially. One limitation to note is that the cadaveric simulation cohort is too small and anatomically unmatched to confirm that the observed pressure shifts are the direct causal driver of cartilage thinning, rather than a correlated finding. Overall, anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction produces persistent posterior displacement of the tibiofemoral contact pressure center, medial 5.29 millimeters and lateral 4.73 millimeters. That spatially corresponds to 9 to 21% focal cartilage thinning on the tibial plateau at 3 years. Moving on, Bellene and colleagues published in Foot and Ankle International titled Defining Radiographic Threshold Values for the Progressive Collapsing Foot Deformity Classification System, a large cohort diagnostic study. This prospective comparative diagnostic study used weight-bearing CT to establish ROC-derived threshold values for radiographic measurements across progressive collapsing foot deformity classes A to D in 321 symptomatic patients versus 154 neutrally aligned controls. Optimal cutoffs were HMA greater than or equal to 13.9 millimeters for class A with AUC 85.3%. TNCA greater than or equal to 38.7 degrees for class B with AUC 84.4%, FAA less than or equal to 8.7 degrees for class C with AUC 83.9%, and sinus tarsi coverage greater than or equal to 25.7% for class D with AUC 84.4%. Multivariate analysis identified HMA, TNCA, middle facet coverage, and sinus tarsi coverage as independent predictors of symptomatic progressive collapsing foot deformity. One limitation to note is that class E, representing ankle valgus, was excluded entirely, limiting applicability to the most advanced presentations. Overall, weight-bearing CT-derived cutoff values for progressive collapsing foot deformity classes A to D achieve AUCs of 73 to 85%, with HMA greater than or equal to 13.9 millimeters, TNCA greater than or equal to 38.7 degrees, FAA less than or equal to 8.7 degrees, and sinus tarsi coverage greater than or equal to 25.7% as the strongest independent predictors of symptomatic progressive collapsing foot deformity. Moving on, Iden and colleagues published in the Journal of Children's Orthopedics titled Rock, Paper, Scissors, OK Game, for neurological examination in pediatric supracondylar humerus fractures, a prospective randomized controlled trial. This single-center randomized controlled trial randomized 102 children aged 4 to 10 years undergoing surgical fixation for supracondylar humerus fractures to classical resident-taught nerve examination versus a smartphone rock-paper-scissors OK game-based protocol. Preoperative examination was faster with the classical method at 4.3 plus or minus 1.3 minutes, but postoperative examination was faster in the game group at 12.2 plus or minus 2.4 minutes with less agitation and non-compliance. Child HCAHPS satisfaction scores were higher in the game group for communication with doctors and keeping you informed. One limitation to note is that retrospective trial registration after study initiation raises serious concern for selective outcome reporting. Overall, a smartphone game-based nerve examination protocol reduced postoperative neurological assessment time to 12.2 plus or minus 2.4 minutes in pediatric supracondylar humerus fractures. Moving on, Abd and colleagues published in International Orthopedics titled Comparison of Subtrochanteric Varus Osteotomy and Shelf Acetabuloplasty in Fragmentation Stage Leg Calvé-Perthes Disease, a prospective randomized study. This prospective randomized controlled trial randomized 32 children with fragmentation stage leg Calvé-Perthes disease to subtrochanteric varus osteotomy or shelf acetabuloplasty to compare clinical and radiographic containment outcomes. Both groups achieved 81.2% good outcomes by modified SUNT criteria, with significant improvement in center edge angle, sharps angle, and medial joint space ratio in each group, and no statistically significant between-group differences. Subtrochanteric varus osteotomy produced clinically significant limb length discrepancy greater than 1.5 centimeters in 43.8% of patients versus 0% in the shelf group. And exploratory Stolberg analysis in the subgroup reaching remodeling stage suggested a possible sphericity advantage with subtrochanteric varus osteotomy that cannot be confirmed at this follow-up. One limitation to note is that the approximately two-year follow-up precedes skeletal maturity in all patients, leaving the most clinically important outcome, final femoral head sphericity, unresolved. Overall, subtrochanteric varus osteotomy and shelf acetabuloplasty produced equivalent clinical outcomes at 81.2% good in each group in Waldenstrom stage 2 leg Calvé-Perthes disease, but subtrochanteric varus osteotomy caused clinically significant limb length discrepancy greater than 1.5 centimeters in 43.8% of patients versus 0% in the shelf group. Moving on, Wilson and colleagues published in JAAOS titled Predictors of Revision Surgery to Promote Bone Healing After Surgical Fixation of Pilon Fractures. This single-center retrospective cohort study identified predictors of revision surgery to promote bone healing in 349 adults undergoing surgical fixation of AO Foundation Orthopedic Trauma Association 43 pilon fractures from 2014 to 2019. Revision surgery to promote bone healing was required in 48 patients, 13.8%, with open fractures at 50.0% versus 24.6%. Higher body mass index at 32.2 versus 28.5 kilograms per squared. And absence of medial column fixation significantly associated on univariate analysis.
On multivariate analysis, fracture-related infection was the dominant independent predictor with an odds ratio of 11.17, 95% confidence interval 4.33 to 28.81, while medial column fixation was independently protective with an odds ratio of 0.41, 95% confidence interval 0.19 to 0.89. One limitation to note is that retrospective single-center design prevents determination of whether medial column fixation was omitted due to soft tissue compromise or surgeon preference. Overall, fracture-related infection with an odds ratio of 11.17 and absence of medial column fixation with an odds ratio of 0.41 are the strongest independent predictors of revision surgery to promote bone healing in 13.8% of surgically treated pilon fractures. Moving on,
Nair and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Effectiveness of a Structured Training Program in Pediatric Distal Radial Fracture Reduction for Orthopedic Advanced Practice Providers. This study compared radiographic and clinical outcomes of pediatric distal radial fracture reductions performed by structured-trained advanced practice providers versus PGY2 residents and PGY4 residents, each during their first 5 independent reductions. Advanced practice providers and PGY4 residents achieved superior initial reductions with less residual angulation and greater percent cortical contact versus PGY2 residents. At follow-up, the advanced practice provider group demonstrated better lateral angulation and AP and lateral percent contact, lower loss of reduction, and lower surgical conversion rates compared to residents. One limitation to note is that only the first 5 independent reductions per provider were analyzed, preventing assessment of learning curve trajectory. Overall, structured-trained advanced practice providers achieved lower rates of loss of reduction and subsequent surgery compared to PGY2 residents during their first 5 independent pediatric distal radial fracture reductions. Moving on, Beber and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled Childhood Opportunity Index and Severity at Diagnosis of Developmental Dysplasia of the Hip. This study examined whether Childhood Opportunity Index 3.0 quintile stratification predicted developmental dysplasia of the hip severity at presentation or Pavlik harness outcomes in patients less than 9 months at a single tertiary center from 2016 to 2023. Low COI and high COI groups showed no significant differences in age at harness initiation, bilateral developmental dysplasia of the hip rate, alpha angle, dislocation rate, need for rigid adduction orthosis at 18% versus 21%, or surgical intervention rate at 10% versus 9%. Despite demographic differences between groups, socioeconomic opportunity did not drive differential outcomes in this cohort. One limitation to note is that tertiary referral center selection bias excludes low COI patients who never receive ultrasound screening or specialty referral. Overall, at a single tertiary care center, low COI was not associated with later presentation age, worse graft alpha angle, or higher surgical intervention rate compared to high COI in 287 developmental dysplasia of the hip patients treated with Pavlik harness. Moving on, Sue and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Timing of Vascular Endothelial Growth Factor Inhibitor Reinitiation and Risk of Wound Complications in Spinal Metastasis Surgery. This study asked whether timing of postoperative VEGF inhibitor reinitiation affects wound complication rates in spinal metastasis surgery. Among 1,164 patients at a single Taiwanese tertiary center from 2010 to 2022, 25.9% developed wound complications within 90 days. Multivariable logistic regression identified VEGF inhibitor use with an odds ratio of 4.12, diabetes with an odds ratio of 4.58, ECOG greater than or equal to 2 with an odds ratio of 3.07, and antimetabolite use with an odds ratio of 2.24 as independent risk factors. Rock and Fisher exact test analyses identified 40 days as the threshold below which VEGF inhibitor reinitiation significantly elevates complication risk compared to non-users. One limitation to note is that single Taiwanese tertiary center limits generalizability across different tumor histologies and healthcare systems. Overall, perioperative VEGF inhibitor use carries an odds ratio of 4.12 for wound complications after spinal metastasis surgery, and reinitiation within 40 days postoperatively is associated with significantly higher complication rates than reinitiation after 40 days. Moving on, Ho and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled Do Prophylactic Antibiotics Decrease Risk of Infection in Closed Percutaneous Pinning of Pediatric Hand Fractures? This 6-institution retrospective study asked whether preoperative prophylactic antibiotics reduce infection after pediatric closed reduction percutaneous pinning of hand fractures. Of 734 patients, 485 received antibiotics and 249 did not. Superficial infection occurred in 0.2% of the antibiotic group versus 2.0% in the no antibiotic group. Despite statistical significance, no difference was found in overall complications by Clavien-Dindo classification, and multiple confounding variables differed significantly between cohorts. One limitation to note is that site randomization means antibiotic allocation is inseparable from institutional differences in surgical prep and pin removal timing. Overall, prophylactic antibiotics reduced superficial infection rate from 2.0% to 0.2% in pediatric closed reduction percutaneous pinning of hand fractures across 734 patients. Moving on. Al-Hankawi and colleagues published in JOA, titled Preoperative Sepsis is Associated with an Elevated Rate of Periprosthetic Joint Infection and Mortality Following Total Hip Arthroplasty in a Time-Dependent Manner. This study evaluated whether preoperative sepsis within 2 years of elective primary total hip arthroplasty increases medical and surgical complication rates, using a national insurance database with propensity score matched controls at a 1-to-3 ratio. At 90 days, preoperative sepsis elevated rates of periprosthetic joint infection with an odds ratio of 1.4, postoperative sepsis with an odds ratio of 3.6, pneumonia with an odds ratio of 2.1, urinary tract infection with an odds ratio of 1.8, acute kidney injury with an odds ratio of 1.4, readmission with an odds ratio of 1.3, and wound dehiscence with an odds ratio of 1.4. Risk was time-dependent. Acute kidney injury, deep vein thrombosis, and readmission were confined to sepsis within 6 months, while periprosthetic joint infection and mortality remained elevated with sepsis up to 1 year prior. Gram-positive sepsis specifically drove periprosthetic joint infection with an odds ratio of 2.1 and periprosthetic fracture with an odds ratio of 1.8. One limitation to note is that the total sample size is unreported, and reliance on insurance claims data precludes adjustment for sepsis severity or residual immune dysfunction markers. Overall, preoperative sepsis within 2 years of total hip arthroplasty increases 2-year periprosthetic joint infection risk with an odds ratio of 1.4, mortality with an odds ratio of 1.5, and dislocation with an odds ratio of 1.3, with periprosthetic joint infection and mortality risk persisting up to 1 year post-sepsis. Moving on, Studeman and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled A Quality Initiative for Posterior Spinal Fusion in Adolescent Idiopathic Scoliosis. Liposomal bupivacaine with dexamethasone use results in substantial reduction in inpatient opioid use. This single-center retrospective quality initiative compared 3 sequential analgesic protocols in adolescent idiopathic scoliosis patients aged 10 to 18 undergoing posterior spinal fusion. Intrathecal morphine plus patient-controlled analgesia, IV methadone plus patient-controlled analgesia, and liposomal bupivacaine plus dexamethasone without patient-controlled analgesia. The liposomal bupivacaine dexamethasone group achieved 0.56 plus or minus 1.43 morphine milligram equivalents per kilogram versus 4.13 plus or minus 0.90 with intrathecal morphine, and 5.32 plus or minus 1.41 with methadone, with length of stay of 2.11 days versus 2.80 and 3.06 days respectively. Pain scores were comparable across all 3 groups, despite patient-controlled analgesia elimination, in the liposomal bupivacaine dexamethasone cohort. One limitation to note is that sequential cohort design with unequal group sizes limits causal inference. Overall, liposomal bupivacaine with dexamethasone without patient-controlled analgesia reduced cumulative inpatient opioid consumption by 86% compared to intrathecal morphine at 0.56 versus 4.13 morphine milligram equivalents per kilogram in adolescent idiopathic scoliosis patients undergoing posterior spinal fusion. Moving on, Hang and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled, Is Dose Reduction After Initial Treatment with Denosumab Associated with Subsequent Skeletal-Related Events, Osteonecrosis of the Jaw, or Osteoporotic Fractures in Patients with Metastatic Carcinoma? A Nationwide Retrospective Comparative Study. This study asked whether denosumab dose reduction strategies by cumulative dose, maximum injection interval, or treatment gap frequency alter rates of surgically treated skeletal-related events, osteonecrosis of the jaw, osteoporotic fractures, and mortality in patients with bone metastases from breast, prostate, or lung cancer. using Taiwan's National Health Insurance Research Database, multivariable Cox and Fine-Gray competing risk models were applied. Extending intervals beyond 90 days was associated with a 2.50-fold higher skeletal-related event risk. And receiving only 3 cumulative doses was associated with a 3.20-fold higher risk, while all dose reduction strategies reduced osteonecrosis of the jaw risk. Prostate cancer patients showed the greatest skeletal-related event vulnerability, with near-complete treatment cessation and a 17.42-fold increase for the 3-dose group. One limitation to note is that the 75.4% exclusion rate creates substantial survivor and selection bias, enriching the cohort with patients who tolerated early therapy. Extending denosumab dosing intervals beyond 90 days was associated with a 2.50-fold higher risk of surgically treated skeletal-related events. 95% confidence interval, 1.35 to 4.66, while intervals less than or equal to 90 days maintained skeletal-related event protection with reduced osteonecrosis of the jaw risk. Moving on, Ogo and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled "The Effect of Liposomal Bupivacaine and Obesity on Postoperative Opioid Consumption in Children with Scoliosis." This single-institution retrospective cohort evaluated whether obesity attenuates liposomal bupivacaine's analgesic efficacy in adolescent idiopathic scoliosis patients aged 10 to 19 undergoing posterior spinal fusion, stratifying 190 patients by body mass index percentile and quantifying opioid use in morphine milligram equivalents per kilogram. Contrary to the hypothesis, obese patients consumed significantly less total inpatient morphine milligram equivalents per kilogram than healthy weight patients, with a beta coefficient of negative 0.50, and the association persisted after multivariable backward selection. Pain scores, SRS-30 outcomes, and pain catastrophizing scores did not differ across body mass index groups, suggesting equivalent subjective pain control despite lower opioid consumption in obese patients. One limitation to note is that absence of a non-liposomal bupivacaine control group makes it impossible to determine whether the obesity-associated opioid reduction is attributable to liposomal bupivacaine pharmacokinetics. Overall, obese adolescent idiopathic scoliosis patients undergoing posterior spinal fusion with liposomal bupivacaine consumed significantly less total inpatient opioid with a beta coefficient of negative 0.50 than healthy weight peers, with increasing body mass index percentile negatively correlated with total morphine milligram equivalents per kilogram. Moving on, Yumbi and colleagues published in JOA, titled "Acute Kidney Injury Following Antibiotic-Loaded Spacer Insertion in Two-Stage Knee Arthroplasty Revision for Periprosthetic Joint Infection, a Retrospective Cohort Study." This study quantified acute kidney injury incidence and risk factors following very high-dose antibiotic cement spacer insertion, mean 8.5 grams per bag, in two-stage revision total knee arthroplasty for periprosthetic joint infection, using a within-patient controlled design across 152 patients at a single academic center from 2004 to 2023. Acute kidney injury occurred in 6.6% after stage 1 and 2.6% after stage 2, with no significant within-patient creatinine difference between stages. Notably, 80% of acute kidney injury cases had no pre-existing chronic kidney disease, and no patient developed acute kidney injury after both stages. One limitation to note is that retrospective design with no documentation of concurrent nephrotoxin exposure or perioperative fluid balance prevents attribution of acute kidney injury to spacer antibiotic absorption. Overall, acute kidney injury occurred in only 6.6% of patients after first-stage very high-dose antibiotic-loaded spacer insertion, with greater than or equal to 8 grams of antibiotics per 40 grams of cement, with 86% of cases resolving within 1 month. Moving on, Jiang and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled "Which Factors Are Associated with Death, Local Recurrence, and Perioperative Complications After En-Bloc Resection for Primary Malignant Tumors of the Mobile Spine." This retrospective registry study from a single tertiary musculoskeletal tumor center evaluated factors associated with death, local recurrence, and perioperative complications in 70 patients undergoing En-Bloc resection for primary malignant mobile spine tumors. 5-year overall survival was 67% and local recurrence-free survival was 67.5%. Intralesional margin was the dominant independent predictor, with a hazard ratio of 11.3 for death and 9.7 for local recurrence. And prior intralesional procedure or open biopsy carried a hazard ratio of 2.9 for local recurrence. Perioperative complications occurred in 50% of patients, postoperative neurologic deterioration in 17%, and three-dimensional printed vertebral body prostheses had a markedly lower revision rate than titanium mesh cages at 2% versus 30%, with an odds ratio of 21.9. One limitation to note is that histologic heterogeneity across 70 patients precludes tumor-specific survival analysis, and wide confidence intervals on T-hazard ratios indicate insufficient power to draw firm conclusions about individual predictors. Overall, en-bloc resection for primary malignant mobile spine tumors achieves 67% 5-year overall survival, but intralesional margin confers an 11.3-fold higher hazard of death, and prior intralesional procedure nearly triples local recurrence risk. Moving on, Chan and colleagues published in Spine, titled Comparing Those Most Satisfied versus Least Satisfied Following Surgery for Cervical Spondylotic Myelopathy, Are There Differences in Baseline Characteristics? This post-hoc analysis of the Quality Outcomes Database Cervical Spondylotic Myelopathy Registry compared baseline and surgical characteristics between the most satisfied NAS1 in 610 patients, 87.3%, and least satisfied NAS4 in 89 patients, 12.7%, at 24 months post-surgery. Multivariable logistic regression identified 8 independent predictors of maximum satisfaction, with higher baseline quality of life carrying the strongest association at an odds ratio of 4.0. The least satisfied cohort showed no significant improvement in any patient-reported outcome at 24 months, while the most satisfied cohort improved across all measured outcomes. One limitation to note is that the binary comparison of satisfaction extremes may obscure patterns in intermediate satisfaction groups. Overall, in 699 cervical spondylotic myelopathy surgical patients, higher baseline quality of life with an odds ratio of 4.0, anterior approach with an odds ratio of 2.3, upper extremity weakness as presenting symptom with an odds ratio of 2.5, and symptom duration under 12 months with an odds ratio of 1.6, were the strongest independent predictors of maximum postoperative satisfaction at 24 months. And finally, Daryl Maas and colleagues published in the Journal of Children's Orthopedics, titled Fracture Morphology and Multidirectional Instability in Failed Closed Reduction of Pediatric Supracondylar Humerus Fractures. This study identified preoperative and intraoperative predictors of failed closed reduction in Gartland type 3 and 4 supracondylar humerus fractures in children aged 2 to 12. Multivariable logistic regression on 318 consecutive cases showed flexion type morphology with an 80% open reduction rate and Gartland type 4 instability with an odds ratio of 5.21, 95% confidence interval 2.69 to 10.53 were the strongest independent predictors of conversion to open reduction. Older age and longer time from injury to surgery were additional significant factors. One limitation to note is that intraoperative classification of Gartland type 4 instability lacks a standardized, reproducible definition, limiting external validity. Overall, flexion type supracondylar humerus fractures had an 80% open reduction rate, and Gartland type 4 instability carried an odds ratio of 5.21 for failed closed reduction in a cohort of 318 children. That wraps up this week's Ortho Digest Rundown, 25 studies reviewed. Head to ortho-digest.com for the full write-ups.